you tell us something about your more recent political experiences? Like, you were assistant prosecutor for under Mr. Ambrose.
Yes, I was one of the assistant prosecutors in 1950. I took a job in the office of the prosecutor on the civil actions, not the criminal actions, the civil actions. And some people think the only thing this prosecutor does is criminal. Actually, some of the most essential things he does is civil. He's a lawyer for every county agency. He represents them. He's a welfare lawyer. He's a county commissioner's lawyer. He is a school board lawyer. He represents everything. He is a lawyer for the treasurer, a lawyer for the auditor. Now, at that time, we had a lot of land here which was delinquent for the non-payment of taxes. And when it's delinquent, of course, it's not being sold, not being used for any good purpose. So we started to, along that line, to foreclose on this delinquent land because the taxes had become too high. Probably resulted from the Depression. When the person got to the point where they could pay, they felt that the land wasn't worth the taxes. So what we would do, we would foreclose and sell it, public sale. Well, let us say someone bought this so-called, what you think, expensive lot for $500. Well, what did he do with it? He put a house on it. Now the taxes value went way up. In the long run, they got every penny back. See how she worked?
Mm-hmm.
We were taking in about $250,000 a year. Not only that value of the land went up because people put a house on it. Well, of course, what does lots of time is when they put in the street, they put on a special assessment for the installation of the street cars. Maybe the street costs $1,000 per lot. The taxes, maybe $300 or $400 in delinquency, $1,400, $1,500, they probably couldn't sell it at that time. When we foreclosed on it, we sold it for $500. And we took the $500 in the treasure, less cost, about $150. But however, the person who bought it was a contractor. The contractor built a home on it. And he put a $10,000 house on it, but now we have a value around close to tax purposes, around $12,000. Before, we got nothing. Now they'll get it all back in short order. And one more thing. I guess you're asking me about what my experience is. I became United States Commissioner here in about 1964. Now, the United States Commissioner, they call him United States Magistrate now. He is actually the preliminary magistrate for the federal government, the federal courts, which central base is in Cleveland. And all these preliminary hearings must come out of the magistrate's office. In other words, if they apprehend a criminal, they have to have a place to take him before a preliminary magistrate. Example, locally, these county courts, they're a preliminary magistrate. Now, they have jurisdiction in certain types of crime, but in felonies, they do not. All they do is have the power to bind over to the grand jury. Now, the federal system works the same way. Almost all types of misdemeanors, which are pretty harsh, too, in the federal system, and the felonies, I'd have a preliminary hearing on, and then if there's probable cause that they were guilty of the crime, then we bound them over to the grand jury, and of course we used the county jail. See, you couldn't be running to Cleveland for every time a man was apprehended for a crime. So I was the federal magistrate here from 64 to 1971.
Is that a hectic period?
No, it wasn't. I didn't have, almost all the cases we had at that time was bootlegging, violation of the arms law, firearms law, bank robberies, thefts of by mail, and theft by Social Security checks. You would think that that would be the same people. It isn't. There's about four or five agencies here that were come in here, and including the FBI, in which the FBI wouldn't even touch it. In other words, if someone sold a Social Security check, the Secret Service would be in here. If someone did something, extracted something from the mail, they had the postal authority. They'd take charge of that. If you had a violation of liquor laws, liquor tax laws, which you want to, that would be the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax Division. Whether you know it or not, it was not one police force. You had to do with them all. Now, what I did, I made up the complaints. They told me the facts I made up the complaints, I made up the warrants, and had the man arrested. Had a bond hearing first to make sure the fellow could get out of jail on bond, and then we had a preliminary hearing on the matter. That was the case.
Would it be hard to change procedure? Is it hard to change procedure if you saw a way to streamline the process and said, hey, this is a better way to do it, let me organize it this way?
Well, it's almost impossible if you feel how this thing works. You got to train a tremendous amount of force. However, we're making changes all the time, small changes. You got to start with the Constitution and what it sets up, some of the even the procedures, and the substance of law. You can't change that. As you know, it's almost impossible to change the Constitution of the United States. For example, you have your procedures under bond law. You're presumed to be innocent, and however they can pass a law, they can set a bond, you know, to assure your appearance. And some people don't realize that. That's an inconsistency. Here you are, have a Constitution presuming that you are innocent. Now, if nothing else was said about it, they couldn't label you with a bond, could they? Because you would be labeled an innocent man. But there is a provision of the Constitution that they can pass laws which they can guarantee that your appearance, and that permits them to do so. Well, sometimes I think it goes too far. I think there's certain types of felonies that you should be required to give a bond. I think a misdemeanor, a person living in this community, why should he be bonded? What's he going to run from? His family? It's ridiculous. The federal system passed the latest one in the bond law. It's been copied over. It's been copied by the state. They had a lot of hearings on it. I read the hearings here. They had a hearing for about 4 or 5 years on, it passed a new bond law, whether you know it or not, a new procedure. They selected the student at Georgetown Law School. They processed all those who were arrested in Washington. Chicago University, the students there processed the arrest and those who made bond in Chicago. And UCLA was selected as a school in California. Maybe there's a one in St. Louis, I don't know. But they come up with this idea that of all the people that were here, that were set for trial, some were laid in jail for 8 or 9 months, and they couldn't make a bond. And I think those people, about 83%, were found guilty. Those people who made a bond, 55% were found guilty. About 30% different, meaning that when they got out in the street, they gave some assistance to their defense. And by the way, there was no mention of running. The people almost all appeared. Now, you always have a percentage of people don't appear, see, they run. And to me, that's always going to happen every place. You got to live on the percentages. Sooner or later, they pick them up. So it's not for good. So that was a great change, and it's been adopted now by the state here, but not applied too well, I don't think.
See your most recent, are you referee of?
I'm the referee for the Court of Domestic Relations.
That was just last year that you?
Middle of November I was appointed that job. And the referee, it's a matter of reference. I hear the cases, I refer to the judge, and I make my decision. He either objects to it or he approves it. And if he approves it, it becomes law, subject to appeal, of course. I take his place, and all my hearings come up. Number one, I have findings. Number two, recommendations. And he usually, not the recommendation, he either accepts me or rejects me. He usually always accepts it unless you have a complaint. You have 14 days to complain. If you don't complain in 14 days, that is it.
I noticed you ran for prosecuting attorney.
I did run for prosecutor. I'm sorry to say about that job. You know, I do a lot of things. I'm really the lawyer for the veterans organizations here. We can't get a lawyer to take over an assistant. Right now, I am probably very actively engaged with the work of the United Veterans Council. Now, that's an organization of 40 veterans organizations. They work on the idea that if we're big, we can do a community-like project in a big way, using all the leaders to help you out. If leadership qualities are necessary, we certainly have it. So I do it that way. Now, we did have about 1955, Ambrose was defeated, and there were a lot of people were running on the next election. Maybe it was 56 or 58. But one of our members, who was really after a job, was running, and I went over and picked up his petitions for him. They labeled me as a person running. Well, I wasn't. Well, two or three veteran leaders asked, yeah, I keep your hat in there. And I said, well, we'll leave it there to see what it can do. And incidentally, I had 5 years experience. So incidentally, I know what the job involved in. They wasn't going to kid me about that. I've been over there for 5 years, and I learned the civil action. And in the meantime, I had studied the criminal action. So I figured, well, I have some qualifications. But when I got halfway through, I had a couple $1,000 in the primaries. And the rule was, you put $5,000, it will attract some people. You're in the primaries. Well, the first thing you know, there's about 8 or 9 people running. They just chopped us all up. And then I ran into somebody that had too much money for me to be. So there's no use running up against him. He had an extraordinary amount of money. So I felt that I didn't drop out. And I think my judgment is difficult to drop out, because someone accuses you of dropping out in favor for somebody, and that's wrong. It's illegal. In other words, you can't be tucked in around there, you dropping out just because a person asks you to. That's going to enable him to win. So I just let the thing run out. So I think at that time, the candidate, Jack Nibel, he won the Democratic nomination. And I think Clyde Osborne was the incumbent. He had been appointed. I think Tom Beale had either died or resigned. And he took over, and then as an incumbent, he defeated Jack Nibel in the election. Now, Clyde Osborne is a judge now.
I read quite a few of the Vindicator articles about the delinquent tax staff. When do you remember that issue? When, I think it was O'Neill became the prosecuting attorney, and then you and three other ones were the delinquent tax staff, and they hassled over whether or not you should be paid for, and then the Republicans came in and appointed another staff, and there were two staffs at one time.
No, Tom Beale won that election. He didn't know how to get us out. By the way, we were appointed very, very, well, selectively. In other words, there's a statute that permits the county commissioners to appoint, to pay for it. The prosecutor appoints you, but the county commissioners pay you. Now that's an important thing. You're not on the prosecutor's budget, and that's what he likes. See, you're not on his budget, you're on somebody else's budget. So we were on actually the county commissioner's budget, but we were nominated for selection by the prosecutor, and we're under his guidance. Well, when they went to discharges, they found out that we were not on his staff, and they didn't know what to do. So I knew what to do, but one of the judges talked to me over there one day about it, and he said, how do we do it? Well, I said, you know, we're not technically appointed by Ambrose. We're on his staff, but our pay, it comes out of the budget of the county commissioner. They were interested in making this appointment years and years ago. It never changed. So I think we worked about 3 months. And they were glad to pay us, and they got the service. And by the way, they have never got that service since. They haven't foreclosed. Well, I'm not going to blame it on them too much, because we had 5 years, we had ridden the tax duplicate of the great and more attractive delinquent tax properties.
I noticed you are quite active in the veterans organizations, and you were a commentator on a...
I am now, yes, I'm a commentator. I'm the commentator of the, what I call the moderator of the Veterans Show, which is a 15-minute broadcast you hear every Sunday morning at 11:30 to 11:45 a.m. in the morning. Now, I cut that tape on Friday afternoon at 1:30, and I have my guest there, and I cut the tape. Now, I've been doing that for 25 years, so it's no hard job on my part. I do have an assistant now, and he takes over sometime too, and because you have to assemble a program, you put it on, it takes some work, see. Now, my program is essentially patriotic, and if I can't work you into that, I forget you, because not many have that type of format. I have it exclusively myself.
far as your political experiences, are there anything else before we talk about the law, your law school experiences? Is there anything else you haven't?
I can't think of anything. I, of course, went along with some of them. I've been working with a lot of veterans organization. I've given some assistance to those people who I thought would do a good job over here. I don't think that that's a deterrent to anybody else. I think good Americanism is good political officers and can do a good job, and that's what I'm primarily interested in. It's just as good as the people you put in there. And, I think, I say in the last three or four terms, I think you've had some real good political officers. I think so.
Okay, let's talk about the law school then for a while. What do you remember about your instructors? Which ones stand out in your mind? Which ones did you learn from? Which ones didn't you?
We're back to where we started before.
That's right.
Now, there was a fellow in Pierre, taught law school, and I think I mentioned Judge Gessner. He was the fellow that ran the thing. He was quite busy being a judge and running the thing. And then we had some other professors who were outstanding. They were practitioners. They were actually the teacher practitioner type of fellow. See, he not only was he a professor, he was out doing the very same thing that he was teaching, and he would show you some of the practical techniques. Now, in a night law school, it's a little bit different than day law school. In a day law school, you got more time to devote for research. A night law school student, he has to study at home, get up to a law library, and make his researches. Now, he can do it in some courses. He cannot do it in all. If every course, like your essential courses, you're having, say, two or three courses a week, would do that to you, and you had to work, it would be a burden that you couldn't cope with. You'd have to lay off work. Now, there was a fellow up there named Knowles Wyatt. I think he's about the meanest guy I ever run into. And we're getting back to what we said before, and he's a guy I'll never forget. He really taught me law. Now, you know, one time we have two types of instructions in law schools. Number one, you have what you call a textbook theory, where you have the same type of text that you have in the school you're attending right now, liberal arts. You have a text there. You follow the text. You have the second type is the casebook theory, in which the various principles of law are demonstrated by a prominent case. Well, but the way they teach that system, of course, you take a case and you go before the class and you explain that case. Now, you will probably go into a theory, for example, of contracts, and you'll have a contract generally what it means. Then you'll go into a case where there's an exception to that, and it breaks it down to the majority of the rule, the minority rule. Well, when you're demonstrating that thing up there in a classroom, many times while you start out that school, I think they admitted about 25 or 30 students. That wasn't many. Well, it got towards the end there, I think I was in a class with four students. Now, how would you like to be hit with about an hour and a half of cases? One, two, four. Three, four. You had to read them all. And I got to know them all. And Wyatt was the kind of a man who wouldn't accept any answer. Why don't you know it? He may turn right around and throw you out for a couple of days. You had to be in class at 7 o'clock. When you came at 7:01, you rapped on the door. He would ask you, why are you late? Well, I'd say, my car broke down. The favorite excuse, you know. He said, well, maybe you better go back home and fix your car. I'll see you sometime next week. Wouldn't let you in. So, sometimes he would be forgiving and say, well, I think your excuse is good. Now come on in and we'll discuss these cases, and you'd go into the meat grinder. And he would want these things, these cases demonstrated. He may ask you some question, what about this other case? How do you apply that? Well, he puts you through a grilling that you never forgot. And by the way, I think his background, he was a school teacher in his lifetime, and he was a mathematician, school teacher, mathematics. And he taught it in high school, and he worked everything out in law school and the practice of law, by the way, of mathematics. I think he did. But by the way, when I later on when I was taking the bar, I could hear those cases wrapping me right in my head and right between the eyes. And we went to a quizzer too. You always go to a quizzer. Why gamble? See? By the way, come under the GI Bill of Rights too. See? So I went to a quizzer up in Cleveland for about 2 months. And they have a way of demonstrating these points. But as far as this class is concerned, he taught me tort law. You know what tort law means, wrong. All these accident cases are tort law. And he taught that to me, and I think he later on taught contract, but he didn't teach it to me. And then the other man was an outstanding man. Was a man named Henry Church, he was quite a fella. He had been a county prosecutor in his day. He had been law director and had a gainful practice of law. And he taught. He taught real estate, real property law, and which was a thing for him to do in a very good way. And he had a theory which always attracted me. And he had an idea. When you come in my class as a working student, you just attend me, you automatically got a C. Just to come to school as a night school student and go through the what he thought was a terrible strain, you were entitled to a C. And by the way, he wasn't too far off. Everybody came in, they were usually always prepared. And that's what he practiced. And that's what he did. That's his theory. Why it would flunk you, everybody would look at you. And however, I'll never forget him because he really made me study. And we're back to what we said before. And the man, the toughest man, is a man we remember. The man who later on became the dean of the law school, a man named Ray Falls. He ran the law firm of Falls, Hazel, and Kerr. I think it's now known as Newman, Olson, and Kerr. He was the man who started that. And he was a very excellent professor, too. He taught a lot of the business courses. The business course, I mean corporate law, partnership law, personal property law, and negotiable instruments, something like that. He taught that type usually in the business. He ran the law firm over here, located in the Realty Building. He later became the dean when Judge Gessner died.
Do you remember much about the students? Like you said, there were about 25 and it would narrow down?
Yes, I remember some. I remember some of them, quite a few of them. We had quite a few here in Youngstown. We were quite prominent. Judge Riggelhop, he was before me. He was a Youngstown graduate. Clyde Osborne. Judge Jenkins, the younger right now, Elwin Jenkins, he was a product of this school, and I think one of the men who became the head of the legal department of Public Steel Corporation came from there. And let me see some of the fellows, a couple of prominent lawyers in town, quite a few of them came from Youngstown. And then they, well, I think there was a great loss when the law school was abandoned. I think they thought there were too many law students coming here practicing or something like that. But one of the reasons was that according to the bar, I think according to requirements, you have to have so many full-time professors, you have to have so many volumes in the library. And I'm sure they had the volumes in the library. They didn't have the 4 full-time professors, which meant they weren't accredited, see. That's why they lost the law school.
Would you be in favor of them reinstating a law school at Youngstown? Do you think the community could use a law school?
I think so. I know that there were some hidden forces who were urging the abolition of the law school because so many law school students were coming out and practicing. But I think that begins to level off, if you want to put it that way. You may have quite a few students come for a while. Then it levels off because they go elsewhere. They go elsewhere to practice law. They go into government, and quite a few of them have been in government that I have seen up there. I haven't seen them since. There are places that they were more attractive, and some of them go in practice law, not practice, but they go with insurance companies, adjusters, things like that. There are places for them, and adjuster, I think he should be some type of a lawyer, or either have some legal background. I think he knows what the school is all about because we're applying the legal principles.
What changes do you think they could have made at the law school that could have made it more rewarding for you? Were there any gripes that you had while you were there that they could have done things a little bit differently? Or?
Not exactly, because the situation is different. If you're the full-time law school mate, don't forget, we were going up there and we were getting a law school training. under the least amount of circumstances of what the bar requires. In other words, I'd get up there, going up there. If you get in law school, you can only take about 2 courses a week, and that's your load unless you're not working. Now, a non-working student, his complaint was, I don't get enough courses. And he was deterred because he said, well, I want to devote all my time to it. Result of that, quite a few of them in that class going down to 4 left. Some went to higher state and some went to higher northern in order to accelerate their law school practice. And I think they were ahead because they got out of school 2 or 3 years before me, and they were practicing law, and they probably made all the money that they had to spend to be there. But at that time, I was very fortunate, and those around town here who wanted a law school training were very fortunate to be given the opportunity up here to take go into a night law school. There's not many like it. And don't forget, we got a back to our old story. We had no ways of getting a scholarship. So I was happy at that time to be able to do so.
Do you think you were well prepared to practice law after you graduated? Or I think you said before we started taping that it's more or less get in there and learn by doing.
That's right. You got to detach yourself. I asked a question to this Henry Church of the lawyer. I said, now I'm in a position. I got a pretty good job at the higher works. I was assistant to the works editor. And I think I had a chance to stay out there if I wanted to in the industrial relations department. They were taking on lawyers. And I told him, I said, you know, I think I would like to practice law here to find out what it's all about. I would like to give it a try. But then again, I have my foot up here, and I'm making a fairly good salary, and I hate to cut it all out to detach myself from the practice, from my job. I have a wife and family now. He said, you know what I would do? I said, what? I said, I'm asking you for it. He says, quit your job. You go in and practice like the rest of it. You take your knocks and your bumps. And as you go through, you're going to find out that you have succeeded in doing this under the most trying circumstances. And I think if necessary, you probably can go back to your job. If you're as good as I think you are, you'll get your job back. Now, what does that mean? Well, he said, you've had all this hardship, haven't you? Yes, he said, it's going to be hard. Your greatest thing is to get clients. So he said, maybe somebody will come into your office, and as you talk to him, he's asking you to do something illegal. All he said, it will be a lot of money for you. But then again, you can look back and say, well, I did this without this fellow before, and I did it when it was hard, and I made a living, and I certainly don't have to take this. And he said to me, under those circumstances, don't make it easy, make it hard.
Pretty good advice then.
I think it was, and I'm glad it was so, although I could have stayed up there. I got a tip to go to Pittsburgh and talk to somebody there connected with the law department of the United States Steel. I said, well, I better at least give it a try. He'll probably talk me out of it down there. I want to see what it's like to practice law.
I think you were an associate with Mr. H.H. Wickham?
Yes, he was here before me. He came in, he was, when I came here, he was about 82 years of age. He'd been an old-time practitioner. I had started the practice law with a lawyer by the name of Ben Roth, and he's over in the Union National Bank building, and I officed with him to begin with. I got a favorable rental from him, and my practice with him, and I think that's a great thing to practice for somebody like that who can give you some ideas on the practical application of this law. And when you get out of law school, you know more law than you'll ever know before in your life. Your difficulty is applying it to various situations. In other words, maybe that law that you have, you won't have a chance in this court. You won't have a chance with the jury. We're not attracted to those types of things. Get away from it, see.
How was the bar exam then? You went to Cleveland, you studied for it. Was it
most difficult of the bars of all taken? It was quite a furore over it. Youngstown University Law School had a good reputation for percentage of passages. We went down to take this law examination, and I had taken a quizzer in Cleveland. Those who operated it was two lawyers named Weiner and Miner. And they had this thing down by lecture all the time, and they just cited case after case, and we bought notes so that we could follow him. You could buy notes. They didn't like it, but these people had the class. They had always had someone who could take shorthand, and they took down their notes, and they would sell it. Sell it for about $12 or $15, worth every bit of it. And I would check out the cases that he was reciting on and add on the bank those I did. So I was pretty well set going down into Columbus to take the law school, I mean, take the bar exam. And as I say, I could go and take the bar exam. I wasn't befuddled one bit. In fact, I was surprised that I didn't do better. I knew the question, and some of them that I know that I fumbled them, although it wasn't that I didn't know them. At first, I was not going to take a quiz. I thought I got a pretty good schooling up here. But someone said, these people, they really put it in a compact parcel for you, see, that you can really get it off at once and pass the bar, and it's worth it because you got to go back again in a year. So I did that, and I came through, and I came home, and we had 4 or 5 people there. We always had, a Monday morning quarterback session after every exam. Got examination in the morning, and examination in the afternoon for 3 days. And every day I just got so disheartened because they told me their answers, and I didn't give that answer, and I got to the point I had to stay away from them. So I went by myself then, and I sat down at the second day, and I figured everything out. I cannot talk to these fellows at all. So I went to each bar exam, and from then on in, I knew I had knocked that thing off. Well, I think we were 4 we drove down together, and out of the 4, I was the only one who passed. I think they flunked 50% that year. There was a furore about it. The law school deans went to the Supreme Court and said, well, here, we've given these fellows, you know, they've had 4 years of schooling and 3 years of law school. We certainly have taught them something. And they think the examinations were too difficult or maybe not graded correctly. So they eased it off a little bit, and the percentage had been greater. There was some merit to what they said. Here's a fellow with 7 years of schooling. He passed the law school, and he should have passed it down there, but only 50%. I never forget my grade. I think the highest grade is about 82%. It was tough, and I had 78.5. So I wasn't too far away, and I flubbed the dub the first week. I listened to these fellas, so I just got myself separated from them. And that's what you do. Stay away from these people. You go to take examination. You figure out your own, and you fall by yourself, not by the companionship of somebody else.
Do you remember what year that was that you passed the bar?
48.
48?
1948, for the record, I'm going to put it in that way.
Could you tell us what your conception of justice is?
Well, don't forget.
Do we live in a just society?
I think we're living in a society the best way you can do it. I think they're going to tell you over here, or any judge will tell you, I can't be perfect. Only God can be that way. We try to do the best we can by what we have available for us, our procedures. Now, there's the procedures is what they're complaining about. And never before have they had such, well, the criminal has such rights. He has become more educated, and so at the same time he has so many rights. You got to read it to him. You can't do anything without a lawyer there. I think they certainly have opened the doors for protection. Now you've got to try him in so many days or he'll be released. He'll shove this docket, civil docket way behind here. We have the best civil docket in the state of Ohio, in Mahoney County. You can be on a trial list in a year. Some of them places 3 to 5 years. Here, what did it? Well, they would take the normal course as far as the criminal docket is concerned. For the thing coming up, the case coming up itself, now they have to push the criminal docket up, the civil docket behind. And all these rights, search and seizures, which some people laugh at us at that, you know, the English system do. They don't have all those types of deterrents. And you have your evidence, your rules of evidence that liberalize. You have the man has certain rights, unless he has an attorney there, unless you read him his rights. Why, of course, that can be directly knocked out. I think he certainly has a lot of rights that he certainly... in comparison to the old fellow 30 years ago who never had the education. Now, I'm going to give one more last word here. I'm going to tell you why my conception is of so many things and why this country has advanced. in advance of the greatest bill that ever passed, the GI Bill of Rights. That gave them a chance to get an education. And those are the things that maybe probably have been troublesome for some of these people. They have taken these exceptions up. And look at what we have here. You have things around here. Down the superintendent of Mahoning County School, Robert Shreve, GI Bill. His assistant, Bob Zorn, GI Bill man. Your prosecutor, your judges, all GI Bill men. They're in the men who got there because a scholarship was provided for them. They may and they may not have. Men and father with them someplace else. But it was GI Bill of Rights, in my judgment, did the greatest thing that ever was. And by the way, you know, I'm on the moderator of the veteran show. And I went after the war was over, they brought me in on this thing, and they had me take over a person who was against the GI Bill of Rights. And by the way, they always give you a very capable veteran. Wonderful war record. He had, I think he had a master's degree in school, teaching school, something like that. And he came on the program with an agency, said, I'm opposed to it. I'm opposed to that, why should I get something for nothing? I did my patriotic duty. Did the Revolutionary War people get anything? Well, I said they got some land. Did the Civil War people get something? No. World War I? No. Why should I get it? What good is it going to do you? Well, all I could say to him at that time, and the veteran leader told me to take him, they didn't want him, I said, you're just going to make a better citizen of him. You're going to open the door of his mind by the way of knowledge, and that's exactly what they have done. These people have made more money now. They pay more taxes. So the government hasn't lost one penny.
That's
right. You don't. It used to be, first came here, you know, the veteran taking everything. Not one thing is saying about the veteran, because the GI Bill of Rights has enabled him to get every bit of the money back. He made more money. He's a moneymaker now.
Would you like to answer about your opinions on capital punishment and abortion?
Well, capital punishment, let me tell you about that. About capital punishment. I think you can go too hard, but you can't abolish it. Now, you mean to tell me that you're going to abolish capital punishment when you have men who are paid to kill you? Let me give you a good example, and you can take this back to your professor. Let us take the time, you probably can recall it, we had an organization in New York called Murder, Inc. Murder, Inc. was devoted to killing people for their insurance. If you didn't like somebody, you would tell those people, and they say, well, now first you insure them, and then we kill them, and then we split the proceeds. There's a man devoted to killing. Are you going to let him off? Not too long ago, there was a group, I think they made an investigation in Chicago, that had these loans they made to these various people at high interest rates. Well, after a while, if you didn't pay, there may be 10% a month, they sent an officer or one of their representatives to you and say, you either pay, and he would probably mutilate you, he would probably almost tear you to pieces to torture you, out of the, torture you for his money. Well, if you didn't have it, the next thing was, you were killed. Somebody ordered your killing. And the most amazing thing about it was, the man who's a criminal, who don't want capital punishment, used it in order to enforce what he wanted, because the word got out, if you don't pay Mr. Joe Doe's back, he kills you. Now, how does it come that it works so well for him in order to teach you your manners, and it doesn't work now? Now, I don't want to say that it should be for everything. I know there's a lot of crime, I say rape and things like that. I think that that's something else. And maybe you used to have it for burglary, too, under certain circumstances. But I think for aggravated murder, especially by these people who were devoted to the business of murder, and you know, you hear about it yourself, the people, they put a contract out for you. Imagine, they decide your life and your death, and they're supposed to go scot-free. What do you think they're going to do when they come out? Aren't they going to go back and ply their trade like they did before? Let's get them off the street. Those things. So I'm saying this. There is nothing absolute on each side. I say you cannot do it here and abolish it all, and over here and say it's all right not to punish. When I was in the United States Commission, I used to hear these fellows talk. You know, sometimes you commit a crime and you're guilty of two crimes. One for the state and one for the federal government. Bank robbery is a great example. We have a state law on bank robbery and a federal law. Usually they hand it over to the FBI. And you know, I used to hear these fellows preliminary hearing, and before an answer, he used to say to me, you know, I didn't know the federal government came in or I wouldn't have done this. I said, why? Because, you know, he said, when I go up to the federal court, they always punish. Yeah, and that's what they were saying to me. I thought maybe I could do it in the local. If they caught me, I had a way to get out of it. This judge, one time he said to me, hey, by the way, shall I waive the preliminary hearing? It's up to you. Who is the judge? I tell him, that's an easy judge. I said, he is? How'd you know? Well, we know about him. He said, how do I get him over quick? Well, the first thing I do, I said, you waive a preliminary hearing, and then you waive indictment. But you don't do it with me. When you get up to Cleveland, you tell the FBI, and you waive indictment, you go right before the judge immediately, and he'll sentence you. So you're in his term of court, see?